From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. People weren't the only ones displaced by weather this week.
We brought 9 horses and 5 dogs. And me and my wife Jessica and 2 trucks and trailers.
That's Jacob Parker of Plant City, Florida. We'll hear stories of other animal evacuees this hour. First, though, the break room recently talked about real service dogs versus fake ones.
A service dog and an emotional support animal, which is what the other category is, are not the same thing. And
right.
I have seen a lot of these dogs untrained barking at the airports. And I'm like, this is not with a service vest on. So people are definitely scamming the system.
Here are your first thoughts, Chris in Savannah.
An actual emotional support animal is prescribed by a physician. It's something that a lot of people truly need, and they are highly trained as well. It's a fairly ignorant comment that hurts those who do actually need them. I know I have one myself.
Hi, this is Julie from Athens. I wonder if anybody's mentioned yet, all of us who suffer from severe dog allergies, and we get asthma, and itchy eyes, and cough, and sneeze. I don't mind suffering for somebody with a real service dog, but not just because you want to have your pet with you.
And to be clear, when we talk about fake service dogs, we're not talking about the ones that are prescribed. We're talking about people's pets where they've put a vest on the pet, but the pet has not been trained as a service animal. We love to get your comments. So call us like Chris and Julie did at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media and we might feature your comments on the show. Both humans and animals fled before the storm this week. Pets and strays now fill animal shelters across the state. And those shelters need to figure out how to handle overcrowding. With me now to discuss this is Tracy Ballou. She's shelter manager for the Macon-Bibb County Animal Welfare Department. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
I understand you're actually still without power.
Yes, ma'am, I am at my personal home.
Yeah. Is the shelter without power?
No, we have power.
How many animals did Macon-Bibb County take in?
At the most, we took in 35 dogs, 17 cats, and 3 rabbits. And then our shelter itself, we actually took 4 dogs from Savannah that were going to be put down if they couldn't find a rescue or someone to take them. So.
Because the shelter had to be evacuated?
Yes.
Let's hear from Laura Bevan. She's with the Humane Society of the U.S., and this is an interview on Fox News, but she's explaining that a lot of people mistakenly leave their pets behind during these storms.
If it's not safe for you to be there, it's definitely not safe for them. People left animals in the mobile home park thinking that, you know, it would be okay, and they went to the shelter, and there was no mobile home park left, and they spent months, you know, searching for those pets.
Animal advocates have tried really hard to get that message out that people should not leave their pets behind. How do you think that went over? Do you think more people were educated on that issue?
You know, I saw a news release say that the governor of Florida was very disappointed at how many animals were left behind. And we actually had some Good Samaritans that evacuated that knew that their like neighbors' animals were left behind, and they actually grabbed them too and brought them to us. There's always an option for your pets, you know, and like we did. We set up the shelters for the people, and then we also had a pet shelter too. So we don't want people to think that that's not an option to save your animal as well, because it always is.
What kind of things, I saw the call out from Macon-Bibb County for donations. What kind of things did you need in order to prepare for all those pets?
Actually, the HSUS donated so many supplies and local citizens.
That's the HSUS is the Humane Society of the United States. Go ahead.
Yes. And we needed kennels to house animals in, blankets, collars, leashes. Be able to walk them. We need water bowls, food bowls, and food for the animals also. And we have received so many donations.
So you guys ended up being covered?
Yes, absolutely.
Is it now, are people now coming to pick up their pets?
They are. I believe at this point, the last time we counted, we had 12 dogs and 7 cats and 1 rabbit.
But what other things are complicated by a storm like this? I understand that it's actually pretty common for pets to go missing during extreme weather.
Yes, it is, very much so. And we've had people in local hotels whose animals have ran away, and some have been injured. And it's really important to microchip your animals, because that makes it so easy for us. If we find a stray animal, we microchip scan it. If it has a microchip, then we can just contact the owners and let them know, hey, your pet's safe. We have it. This is where you can pick it up.
So that means two different things, right? There's the first one, which is microchip your pets. But it also means that if you find a pet, you need to get it to a place like a veterinarian's or a shelter where they can scan for a chip.
Yes, we actually do ask that people do not pick up strays, because you never know the behavior of the animal. I've picked up a dog before that I thought was just super friendly, and then once I got him in my car, he was not. So I learned my lesson a long time ago, but we do ask that you just contact the animal enforcement officers.
People are sometimes nervous to do that, though, because they're afraid the dog's going to, or cat is going to go to the shelter and be put down.
Oh, goodness, no. You know, we try our hardest not to have to euthanize any healthy adoptable animals, and we've been doing a wonderful job at that over the past year and a half. Animals that have behavior issues or any forms of aggression, we do have to put those down, because that's for the safety of the community. But healthy adoptable animals, we work with so many rescue groups and have such wonderful adopters. And, I mean, we even send our animals up north to Canada and down to Florida and all around the country. So we have a really good save rate for our animals.
So don't be nervous. The message there is, don't be nervous about calling the shelter to pick up a stray pet.
No, not at all.
So
take wonderful care of the animals.
What other kind of things occur? I mean, how stressful is an event like this for a pet who obviously doesn't understand what's going on?
Oh, it's very stressful. You know, they're just thrown in a vehicle and drive hours and hours, and then they're dropped off at a place where they don't know anybody and don't understand why their moms and dads aren't there. And so it is very stressful for them. We have a few at the shelter now that are really stressed out and have severe aggression.
So,
but
go ahead.
We managed to handle getting them calmed down and a little bit more relaxed.
Okay, so in future storms, when other upcoming weather, bad weather may be coming, I know the coastline, for example, has now seen two bad storms in relative succession. So what is the best advice for you for pet owners, to keep a pet with them? Or because there's concern about where they may be staying, is it best to find a shelter or someplace to house a pet during weather like this?
Anytime a local government opens up an animal shelter, anytime we do with Macon Bibb County, we're always going to have a pet shelter as well. So please just go ahead and bring your animals. You know, and I believe other counties, they also do this as well. Whenever they open up a shelter for people, they go ahead and open up a pet shelter. Not everybody does it, but you shouldn't have a hard time finding that resource.
How many pets are still left? How many pet evacuees are still at the Macon shelter?
I believe we have 12 dogs, 7 cats, and 1 rabbit right now.
Waiting to go home, right?
Yep, just waiting.
Tracy Ballou is shelter manager for the Animal Welfare Department of Macon Bibb County. Tracy, thank you so much. I hope you get power back.
Thank you so much. You have a good day.
You too. Hundreds of evacuated horses, goats, cows, and other critters took refuge this week at the Georgia National Fairgrounds south of Macon. GPB's Emily Cureton brings this audio postcard.
I'm Jacob Parker. I'm from a little place called Plant City, Florida. We brought 9 horses and 5 dogs. And me and my wife, Jessica, and 2 trailers, 2 trucks and trailers. Did the best you can. Can't get any supplies at home. There wasn't any plywood available. You know, just pretty much just get on the road and try and save what you can.
Suck that down.
Paige May.
I'm Buddy.
Fab. Fabulous Fab. He's a Westphalian. He's a dressage horse. He's not doing too well. We've been in touch with the vet and, you know, pre-treating him and everything for ulcers. And I think the storm bothers him. They know it's out there. They feel our stress. And so it's real important for us to stay calm so that they stay calm.
I'm Glenn Wilson, and right now I'm acting as the barn coordinator. Just show people where the stalls are, and if they need anything, try to get them an answer. And we just had a trailer load of hay donated to us.
They eat about, she eats about 6 pounds a day. And so hay, you're talking most horses, you're using a bale of hay a day. My name's Ann Ecker, and I'm from Grace Stables, and we're located outside of Savannah, which in Richmond Hill, Georgia. We went through Matthew, and it was horrible. You know, our neighborhood was just destroyed during Matthew.
I'm Bert Wilson, and my official title is I'm the receptionist here. We are taking mostly horses. I have noticed a donkey in there, and I've been told we have some goats out here now, but mostly horses.
You grumpy. Grumpy. Kayla Simmons, Littlewissie, Georgia. I have the 5 dogs, 4 tortoises, 5 turtles, macaw, the 2 ferrets, the 2 chinchillas.
Hello.
The 2 cats. Who am I missing?
The only member of the Simmons family who didn't evacuate was Kayla's husband. He's a law enforcement officer who remained in the Savannah area. That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curtin. To see pictures and video of animal evacuees and their owners, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, author Darren Wong takes us deep into his latest novel. But first, how rescinding DACA will affect Georgians. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last week, the Trump administration announced plans to end Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's DACA. That grants legal protections to people who entered the U.S. illegally as children. Here's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
To have a lawful system of immigration that serves the national interest, we cannot admit everyone who would like to come here. It's just that simple. That would be an open borders policy, and the American people have rightly rejected that.
DACA will remain in place for 6 months to give Congress time to enact a replacement policy, and that means about 800,000 people across the country who rely on this program, they're known as Dreamers, are now in legal limbo. One of them joins us now, and it's a name I really enjoy saying, Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. She moved with her family from Uruguay to Gwinnett County, Georgia, and she attends Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Hi, Valentina.
Hi there.
Although I'm tempted to basically say your entire name every time because I love saying that name. You moved here when you were six. Do you remember it?
I do. I remember, you know, I have a few selective memories of Uruguay, and I remember the plane ride. I remember getting off the plane. I remember seeing my dad after almost 4 months of not seeing him and how different it was from my country.
So there is going to be pushback immediately on this interview as we move forward with people saying, why start illegally? Why not go through the process legally as it's set forward? What's your answer to that?
I think what a lot of people don't understand is that the concept of legality and illegality when it comes to immigration is already set up rules. And so a lot of the time it comes down to privilege, right? In my country, we didn't have the privilege of even knowing how to come here legally and the legal ways of doing that. We were just very desperate to get out of a country. And my parents were very desperate to make sure that my brother and I were set up for success and for prosperity. So, you know, now I hear a lot of pushback and talking about like, well, you should have done it right. Your parents should have done it right. You know, it's a lot of talk about like, well, what is right? And if there is a way to do it legally, then why aren't there more legal immigrants, quote unquote, legal immigrants? And, you know, it comes back to the get in the line myth or get in the line excuse that people use. And there is no line. There is no concrete, easy, fast, legal way to become a citizen or a resident here.
But you have been here basically since you were in first grade. Do you consider yourself American?
Well, yes. I mean, besides being, you know, being born in a South American country, and that already grants me Americanness, you know, yes, I do consider myself American because I've fully assimilated into this country. I know more about this country, its history, its people, its culture, everything, more so than Uruguay. You know, I like to think that Uruguay was like my birth country or like my birth mother that gave me up for adoption, and the United States took me with open arms and has given me everything.
So what changed for you? How different was it after Obama signed DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as opposed to before?
I think that once DACA came about and I became a DACA recipient, the world opened up to me, right? It was very apparent to me, especially being in high school and seeing all my peers and all of my friends, being able to drive and do, I guess, the regular teen things, going out at night, doing, you know, driving. And then when it came to my senior year, applying to college, and I had to have a really rough conversation with my mother about being undocumented and what that meant for me. And that meant, you know, not being able to drive, not really going outside during certain times to not be caught by the police, changing my whole life and my whole life routine around just to avoid being seen and being known as an undocumented person. So once DACA did come about and Obama did sign that, I was able to work. I was able to help my parents and my family economically. I was able to get a license. But the thing is with DACA, as you know, thankful and as privileged as I am to be an undocumented person with DACA, what people don't understand is DACA is a very exploitative thing. The only thing that it grants me is a license and a work permit. It doesn't necessarily grant me a higher education, as is seen in Georgia, where undocumented students are banned from the top three universities now, where it used to be the top five, because of the Board of Regents Policy 416, and we are barred from financial aid because of Policy 434.
And DACA is expensive, too. You pay money to be part of that program. How much do you pay?
They just augmented it this past year or this year. I think we pay around $500 to $600 to file that. And plus, if we use an attorney to do that for us, it might be even more, like up to $1,000, $1,500.
So now that DACA has been or will be basically rescinded, what are you worried about?
Being at Dartmouth, I'm worried about my literal safety. And this is because I've had individual students and student organizations threaten to deport me. So that's a very big thing for me.
Your fellow students say they're going to have you deported?
So my freshman year, there was an incident where I got a message from an individual student that likened or kind of insinuated that if I ran for a student government position, that he could very easily call immigration. And then last year, after Trump got elected, a student organization on campus said that they could call ICE and have all the undocumented students deported at Dartmouth. And, you know, people didn't understand that that is a direct threat to our lives. And it was just very hard.
I can't imagine if you were deported back to Uruguay, what would you do? You were six when you left there.
Right. I think being my 15 years being in the United States, I've thought about it a lot. Going back, I've had dreams about it too, countless dreams about going back. But the thing is, I don't know anyone. I don't know anything. I've grown up in this country with just my parents and my siblings. You know, I have seen my friends go to their cousin's house, their grandparents' house, and my grandparents died while I have been in this country. I don't know where they're buried. I wasn't there for them when they died. You know, if I were to go back to Uruguay, my whole family's, the six of us, we'd be living in a shed with an outhouse with maybe electricity. My family and I have talked about this a lot. We don't have anywhere to go. And to liken that to where we live now, where we live in a house, where we have, you know, a dog, we have food in our fridge, we have all these privileges, and to go back to a country that I literally know nothing about would be just devastating.
That is Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. She is one of roughly 800,000 people who rely on the federal DACA program. Last week, President Trump announced plans to get rid of that program within 6 months. Valentina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, we want to focus on some of the facts about the DACA program. Announcing the president's decision last week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions made this claim.
It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs.
We want to fact check that, not just that, but many other things related to DACA. Wesley Tharp is research director with the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Good morning.
Morning, Celeste. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you back. Can we start with this? The Jeff Sessions claim that DACA denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans?
That's outright false, Celeste. It's a common misconception that immigrants, whether here on a legal permanent basis or a temporary lawful basis or having originally come to the country illegally, are taking jobs from native-born Americans. But what actually happens with immigration is that immigrants grow the size of the economy as a whole by being workers, entrepreneurs, contributing to their communities, being taxpayers. And so for every job that an individual foreign-born person may quote-unquote take, let's say, for example, an immigrant taking a job on a construction site, they create jobs elsewhere in the economy by circulating those dollars throughout the economy that essentially cancel out any of the lost jobs, or some economists believe benefit the economy perhaps substantially over time.
And this is backed up by numbers. This is not your gut feeling.
Oh, absolutely. This is, I would say, the consensus of mainstream research on the economic benefit of immigrants is that over the long term in particular, the benefits are absolutely positive of additional immigrants coming to communities and to the country as a whole, in the same way we see benefits from native-born people coming to Metro Atlanta or to Georgia as opposed to these communities who are losing population over time. There's some debate about what are the short-term impacts, because there, you know, there are some pressures there, particularly
short-term
in certain
means
industries.
6 months to a year, or
when, say, there's a heightened amount of immigration in a short-term period.
I see.
Are there jobs being, again, quote unquote, taken in certain industries that might have a large percentage of immigrants? But again, the consensus, I would say, is that those impacts, even in the short term, are either zero or just very, very minor.
Let's hear this comment from Alex Narasta of the Cato Institute. He says about 91% of DACA recipients are employed. This is him speaking on Fox Business.
They pay in federal taxes about $60 billion a year over the next decade, more than they consume in benefits. And their contribution to American GDP over the next decade will be about $280 billion. Rescinding their work permits does not mean that they leave the United States, does not kick them out. It merely means that they're deprived of jobs.
So if that means that they lose their jobs, that means we lose that $60 billion in taxes if DACA is rescinded?
Right, and let me bring this home to Georgia in particular. Our research indicates that the about 47,000 Dreamers in Georgia, people who are either receiving DACA currently or who are immediately eligible to apply, contribute $66 million a year to Georgia in state and local tax revenue. If those young people who were brought to this country as children were deported, Georgia would lose that entire $66 million a year. If they lose their DACA status but were allowed to stay, they wouldn't be working as often. They would be receiving lower wages, and so that contribution would shrink substantially.
So, okay, let's hear another comment. And this is talking about their wages. This is Richard Trumka, and he oversees the AFL-CIO, the union. He says ending DACA would actually make workplaces less safe.
It'll make it more difficult for us to come together to raise wages for everybody. There are 800,000 people that are making contributions every single day, taking away their rights, making them exposed to being fired at will is not only cruel, it's very, very wrong for the economy. It's a wrong thing to do.
What do we know about the way that DACA recipients in particular affect wages or labor standards?
That's a very good question. I would say that legal status for the immigrant community does have very important implications for workers as a whole, because when there is a large pool of potential workers that don't have the ability to negotiate, don't have the ability to complain, to what have you, it undercuts the legal workforce. And so that's just one example of how having a system for immigrants to be treated fairly, to bring them into the fabric of our communities and our economy, spills over into benefits for people as a whole, regardless of whether they were born here or what their legal status is.
How united is this opinion? You said this is basically the opinion of most major economists and people who look at these things rather broadly. But, I mean, there are people, economists, who disagree, right? How universal is this view?
Sure. Well, I would, again, point to this concept of looking at the economy as a whole long-term versus looking at sort of individualized short-term or perhaps industry-specific effects. So the economy as a whole long-term. As more immigrants come to our communities and come to this country, they're getting jobs, they're pumping money back into the economy, they're starting businesses, they're paying taxes, which then go to positive investments like schools and roads. Those things grow the overall size of the economic pie over time. There's almost universal agreement about those long-term impacts. What we see a little bit more debate around are particularly what are the effects of predominantly lower-wage industries sort of immediately when, let's say, a large group of immigrants come in. And there's a minority of economists who think that there are some small effects on wages short term. But again, the broader consensus is that for every one job that is taken in a certain industry, every job that's taken in a particular industry, say construction or manufacturing, the increased economic activity from the wages that that immigrant worker receives and then pumps back into the economy balance those things out.
So we have about a minute left. How concerned are you, as part of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, about this 6 months of limbo of you know, the economy doesn't particularly like uncertainty. How concerning is that?
My primary concern is that there are about 47,000 young people in Georgia brought to this country as children who could see their opportunities and their futures stripped away by this decision. If Congress does not come to some sort of bipartisan agreement to put a fair plan in place for these immigrants to get on the path to legal permanent status or the path to citizenship. There are about 1 million immigrants in Georgia as a whole. About 1 in 10 Georgians was born outside the United States. About 1 in 5 Georgia school children have an immigrant parent. All of those people, whether dreamers or not, deserve to be treated fairly and to have opportunities to maximize their contributions.
That's Wesley Tharp of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Just ahead, a new novel offers a fresh take on the Civil War. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk about how LP records are making a comeback in Georgia. Athens-based Kindercore Vinyl is pressing new albums all the time. So, what vinyl records do you still have? Or did you dump them all for CDs and MP3s? You can call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Author Darren Wong's new novel, his first, is called The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. It offers a fresh take on the American Civil War. Darren is also co-founder of the Decatur Book Festival, and that's where his new book was launched. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So almost as interesting as the actual story in the novel is the story of how this novel came to be. Now, did you know about this history before you found out you were living in that house?
No, so we moved into this house when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, the whole bizarre history didn't even, you know, as a five-year-old, it doesn't really intrude into your mindset. And, you know, parts of it kind of were presented to us, but it didn't fit together. And, you know, some of it was wives' tales and crazy and stuff like that. So kind of discovering what was true and what was not was a lot of the fun.
So you ended up in is this town that you write about is Townline, New York.
Yeah.
And the interesting tidbit about it is that it was the only town. It's just outside Buffalo, right?
Yes.
It's the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line that seceded.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, did not rejoin the Union until like the 1940s?
1946, January 1946, to be precise.
So you pitched this for years to authors to have them write it as a book.
Yeah, I mean, because somebody ought to, right?
So give me an example of how you pitched them.
Well, if you're out drinking with authors or something like
as
I would often do because with the festival, and you know, these stories would come up, you know, of in particular down here in the South, of bizarre Southern, you know, the granddad or great granddad buried the silver in the backyard kind of
right.
of stories, and I would say, you want a real Southern story? How about this? You know, my town, 15 miles from the Canadian border, seceded from the Union, and my house was on the Underground Railroad. You should write that. And they go, you know, and then I would do.
And you could never convince anyone to write that story.
No, you can't convince anybody to write a story. Everybody has a, you know, it's not hard to come up with a good story to write. It's the work of spending a couple of years of your life on it. That's the hard part.
So you, and before that, you had been a writer, but you'd written short stories and shorter pieces. You had never written a full length book.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't even really taken on fiction at all. I'd written pieces for, you know, journalist pieces, reviews and stuff like that, but I never really taken on a novel.
So you described it to the AJC as that you had to teach yourself how to write in order to do this book.
Yeah, well, you know, how to write a good sentence, you know, it's not easy to put on to, you know, to get the rhythm and the complexity of a good sentence and have different things going on. And you know if you pay attention to those things, it's not, you know, hopefully as a reader you never notice it, but as a writer you want to get it right.
So how do you teach yourself to write a novel? I mean, how does one do that? I mean, you've been reading, assuming, your whole life. So what else do you need to do?
Well, one perfect example is the main character, Mary Willis, who's running this Underground Railroad station, right?
Yeah.
You know, and her true history is she had 17 siblings. So, and I have a list of all those people when they were born and everything like that. So as I start to write, I feel like all of those siblings have to be in there, right? And I have a draft where she has 17 siblings and they get named at some point. It's terrible.
Yeah, you can't keep track of all of them.
You know, they serve no purpose. They just exist there. And, you know, in particular around writing historical fiction, it's about as much about what goes as what stays, you know. And so learning that, how to make sure the when the chapter ends that you want to turn the page and go to the next
cliffhanger,
chapter.
Right?
Yeah, that there's something driving it forward. That the idea that nothing should be in a sentence or in a paragraph or a page that doesn't need to be there, you know, all those kind of ideas.
So tell me a little bit about Mary, your main character, and what was true and what isn't. I mean, Mary, I think lively is a fair word. She's quite young, just out of college, just a fierce 19th century feminist. So how much of that did you create?
Well, so Mary Willis, the true story of Mary Willis is she went away to college at Alfred University in 1857. She was about 18 years old at the time. Well, you know, women did not go to college in 1858. And she went to Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to take women.
Yeah.
And it was Alfred is about 30 miles from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the epicenter of feminism. So these things come together. And Rochester, New York, is where Frederick Douglass is writing. So all of these radical ideas are floating in the ethos in Western New York at the time. So it's reasonable to assume this woman is. I mean, she's imbued with this kind of feminism, and so that's. I'm taking that as true, right? She goes to college. She comes home, 1858, and starts running an Underground Railroad station.
From the house
barn.
That you ended up living in.
Yeah. Well, it was a barn at the time.
Oh yeah.
Right, and it was converted into a house
so
later.
So that part's true.
Yeah, all of that's true.
Did you find any writings of hers that might have given you a clue to her personality or the way she spoke?
No, that was all
invented.
Yeah, I have some her signature on some legal papers and stuff, but I've never found any of her writing. I'm convinced she married at one point and moved across the street from this house, and then she moved home because the other house burned. And I'm convinced that her stuff was there because a college educated woman would have kept papers and diaries and stuff at the time.
But it may have gotten burned in the fire.
I feel like it was burned, but I also when I was a child my parents came to made a trade to have all the stuff cleared out of the house, and there's a guy who came and took the stuff, and he had a diary in his hand, and he said, "Oh, look, I think that's a woman's hand." But I people ask me if that was hers. I don't know. I fantasize that it was, but I was 5 years old. I couldn't even read it. You know, I have no idea what it was. Could have been the previous owners.
So this must be. I have to imagine this happens with everyone who writes historical fiction, where the reader is sitting there going, "Wait, which part of this is true and which isn't?" So, were there actually Confederate secret agents having raids across the border?
Can you believe that? I mean, nobody talks about this, but there was the Confederate Secret Service was run by a guy named Jacob Thompson, who there's a large monument to Jacob Thompson in downtown Oxford, Mississippi. He is and he became the basis for the Thompson family in all of Faulkner's books. One of the Faulkner's books, he was implicated in 1865 in the John Wilkes Booth conspiracy, and had to flee the country. He lived over in England on $200,000 of mysteriously appeared hard cash. For several years there, before moving back to Oxford after supposedly clearing his name, but that, whether it was never really cleared. But there was this whole outlandish plot with Johnson's Island. Historically, this is true that he hired a guy named John Yates Beale, who was from right around Harper's Ferry. West Virginia. It was Virginia at the time. It hadn't split off. To go to Johnson's Island, which is where there's an island full of Confederate soldiers that were prisoners, to take them to Buffalo, to break them free, arm them, take them to Buffalo, and set them loose to open up a northern front. This is all documented plot. It fell apart, obviously.
Clearly.
but these kind of, you know, we'd never think about the Canadians' influence in the Civil War, but it's quite an active board at the time.
So why is there such fodder for fiction coming out of the Civil War? Why do we seem to never tire of those stories?
Well, I think, aren't we fighting the Civil War essentially in some ways right now? I mean, we're not in the street, generally not in the streets with guns, but.
Well, they were in Charlottesville.
Yeah, they were in Charlottesville. Those battles still rage one way or the other. It's, you know, in my opinion, one of the tragedies of the Civil War, one of the wounds that has never been healed was, you know, with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, you know, there was never a proper movement to reconcile. You know, Johnson, you know, his
he was all about appeasement, yeah.
Yeah, it was never to get it right after that. And we've never healed from it.
So you had to create, let's go back to the town. I want to make sure I say it right. It's Townline, New York.
Yes.
And this was settled by Germans. This is a real town.
Yes.
And let's talk about how this town came to secede, which was part of the whole beginnings of this novel, right?
Yes. So first off, Townline, New York is a hamlet. It's a crossroads. It has no legal standing. It is the line between Alden, New York, and Lancaster, New York.
It's literally a town line.
Yeah, it is. There's no mayor. There's no city council. There's no legal standing. There's no. They have a volunteer fire department, and up until a few years, the volunteer fire department, their shoulder patch said "Last of the Rebels," 1865 to 1946, which is incorrect because, of course, they actually seceded in 1861. But you know, there's a mythos going on here anyway, right? So, there's no contemporary documentation for the secession, but it's pretty clearly established that it happened. It was a vote of 100 to 23, it's not quite clear what happened now
or why.
Yeah, so,
I mean, you imagine for your novel a lot of those motivations and what was happening in the town at the time, but historically, do we have an answer to that?
Well. So, Townline, which is a pretty right-wing place today and has been for a long time.
I would imagine if they had those patches on there, yeah.
They imagine an alignment with the Confederacy, and there's a claim that they sent seven soldiers south to seven of their local boys south to fight in the War of Northern or in the Army of Northern Virginia. There's no documentation for that. I've never seen a name of anybody that did it. It's a very hypothetical thing. And that kind of thing, that story kind of floated in 1946 when the reunification happened. But the real historical basis is, I've talked to descendants of people who were there. And largely the idea that I put out in the book is, I think, holds water.
The book also sort of forces us to contend with this idea of being an outsider. I mean, she's in the North, but she herself is very progressive. She went to a co-ed college, which at that time is very racy. And she's surrounded by this very conservative, as you describe even today, right-wing town. Is that something that you had experience with, or was that a sort of situation of being just kind of Cassandra screaming behind the walls of Troy, right? Was that a situation you had to fully imagine?
No, I'm half Asian, I'm half Chinese, and I grew up, I mean, there's not a minority, or there certainly wasn't besides me
in
Town Line when I was growing up. That kind of outsider status just felt absolutely natural to me. It wasn't hard to guess.
And the love story is imagined, is it not?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so you had to create, that wasn't her eventual husband, real eventual husband?
I don't know. How much should we spoil here?
So, don't spoil. Yeah, don't. Yeah. Don't tell that part. I don't want to lead you to any spoilers. But what I mean is, was there something in her eventual married relationship that you borrowed for the love story?
So I tried very hard to put Mary back down where I found her. I tried to pick her up historically. When the book starts, it's kind of where she is historically, and I tried to put her down right where she would have been at the time. But everything else is
in between.
I take quite a few liberties in between. I'll grant you that. She ended up. Well, we won't spoil that.
No, don't spoil that.
But I will say, I think what you're asking about at root is perhaps that is Joe. The book opens with Joe, a fugitive slave who arrives at her farm, and he is a complete figment of my imagination.
So, what's your final decision on novel writing? You had to go through this whole process just to get this novel out.
I'm looking forward to having time. I've got a long book tour ahead of me, and I'm looking forward to getting back to sitting down and taking on the next
and
one.
And maybe doing the next, yeah. A second novel.
Yeah.
So you're a convert.
Yeah, I'm an absolute convert now. After you spend all that time figuring out how to do it, you don't just do it once.
Okay, so the next person that comes to you and pitches an idea, are you going
I will tell them what all my writer friends told me. He said, that's your story. You have to write it.
Author and Decatur Book Festival co-founder Darren Wong, his new novel is called The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, and it's out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but as always, we'd love to hear from you. Are you still without power from the storm? How would you rate the state's response to Irma? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a good day.